With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. The weather pushes the melon crop past July 4th, but growers are happy with the quality. California farmers say this season's melon crop was delayed about 2 weeks due to cool temperatures and wet fields affecting early harvest of watermelons, cantaloupes, and honeydews. That slowed melon deliveries to supermarkets. Fresno County farmer Joe Del Boss says, quote, "We missed the big marketing window for 4th of July." But Del Boss adds that the quality of the melons this year is good and that demand remains steady. He said he just hopes that there's not, quote, "a bunching up of melons hitting the market all at once." That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. Transportation and agriculture go hand in hand. Matt Clark, analyst at Terrain, conducted a study on the impact of zero-emission trucking rules on the agriculture industry. He said when looking at the bigger picture,
what I would highlight is thinking about it real broadly. If you think about ag and transportation, specifically truck transportation, they are so tied together. And they've had such a long, long history of mutually kind of benefiting each other and being dependent on each other. So there was some work from the USDA that found that about 80% of all ag freight moves via truck at some point, and roughly 25% of all truck freight is somehow related to agriculture, whether that's an output or an input. And so when you step back and think about it, I don't think ag was the target of these rulings. I don't. But ag is going to be involved in this. And if you are, for example, a fruit and vegetable person in Salinas Valley, and you're traditionally hauling your product 350 miles to Los Angeles, hey, this is going to impact you in a pretty big way. You know, you're going to have to rethink your system. Unfortunately, for your listeners, California is kind of at the tip of the spear. They're going to be the first to really explore this. And my recommendation would be to not procrastinate on thinking through this issue. You know, make sure that your alliances, your partnerships, your organizations that you're backing, make sure that they're working on this and thinking about this critically, and that there's partnerships all along the supply chain. If we learned anything during COVID, it's that the supply chain and ag are vital to each other. And this is going to be another one of those issues that will impact both. So let's work together to figure out the answer now, as opposed to kind of waiting until 2036 or something when we're too far down the line.
To take a look at that report, visit terrainag.com/insights. And now here's AgNet West Brian German with more agriculture news.
Collaboration has been a central focus of the Sustainable Pest Management Roadmap for California. Director of the California Department of Pesticide Regulation, Julie Henderson, said the ag industry has been involved since the beginning and will remain engaged as the roadmap is implemented.
That was really the goal of putting the work group together to begin with, to develop the roadmap. And so we really were trying to ensure that as we were developing this roadmap, it had the perspective of many from the agricultural industry. And so as we're thinking about this next phase of rolling out, we've been meeting with different groups of growers, as well as our local county ag commissioners, to have conversations about what concerns they have about the implementation of the roadmap, how they can be supportive, how we can work together in a collaborative way on the implementation. And so all of these conversations that we're having and we've been having over the last couple of months and we'll continue to have will really help inform our planning for implementation of the roadmap, as well as identifying needs for funding to actually see the roadmap fully implemented.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Why do you listen?
It's just nice to have local.
I listen from 8 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock at night.
I just want to stay informed while I'm on the go.
It keeps me up to date with everything going on in the world.
When you put the lights on the barn, the radio went on.
It moves pretty quick so I can get the message and get on with my day.
Oh, listen in the barn, skid loader, tractor, and just about anywhere you can.
Why do you listen? Go to whyilisten.com, tell us why you listen, and you have a chance to win $500. Visit whyilisten.com today.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, the Growing Access to Environmental Sustainability Act, or GATES Act, seeks to reduce barriers that producers face in accessing agricultural conservation programs. Congressman John Duarte, a farmer from California, is on the coalition behind the act. He says current adjusted gross income limitations disproportionately limit producers with high input costs from participating in certain USDA conservation-focused programs. The GATES Act would exempt the AGI limitation for farms that get 75% of their income from farming or related farming practices, such as agritourism, direct-to-consumer marketing of agricultural products, and the sale of agricultural equipment owned by the person or entity. Duarte says specialty crop farmers are especially blocked when it comes to the AGI limitations.
No, that's very, very much the case. If you look at a viable farming operation, you know, over towards Jimmy's area in the Salinas Valley or along the coast there, you could easily run into a broccoli or a greens or a vegetable grower over there running up against these limits. And to be competitive in that industry, these vertical family farms have to reach a certain size. You know, if they're going to serve the larger grocery chains, if they're going to have a cold storage, a marketing desk, a grower, packer, shipper model, they're going to need to reach a certain critical mass, so they're just not going to be relevant. And in the Central Valley, where I farm, there's a lot of families who have vertically integrated over the years. They may have an almond growing hull or sheller as well as a marketing shipping operation in almonds. They may have a large dairy. And to be viable these days, a lot of dairy operations are getting above, you know, 1,000 cows can be a smallish dairy in California these days. 5,000 cow dairy is not unheard of. My grandfathers both had 20 cow dairies. So it's just important that we kind of adopt these programs to the realities of the marketplace we have. And California agriculture is outgrowing the limits placed in these programs.
The bill would apply to the Conservation Reserve Program, or CRP, Environmental Quality Incentives Program, or EQIP, and the Conservation Stewardship Program, CSP. Congressman Duarte says it's important to allow more access to these programs.
Well, it's important to make them accessible to every farmer. We don't want any small farmers that want to get into the business not to have access to the same advantages or the same incentives that larger farmers have. But when we start looking at the overall goals, for instance, under the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, we want to protect our groundwater. And so we may want to have a EQIP program for a large grower to put in recharge basins. Or we may want to have an EQIP program for a large grower to use micro-irrigation, drip, or small sprinklers instead of flood irrigation. Or we might want to have a program where a large grower can put in the capital infrastructure needed to access surface water to a farm that has previously only been irrigated with groundwater, so that when we have surface water years like we did this year in California, when there's abundant surface water, these large growers can access that surface water, recharge it, use it on their crops, and protect the groundwater for all farmers for drier times. And so if we don't include the largest growers in these programs, we don't really get the economic impact that's the potential there. Small growers are oftentimes taken care of, and we've done things in the past, like set up separate accounts for organic or small growers to make sure that all of these programs aren't exhausted before the smaller growers can get access to the resources they need from these programs, and that can be very important as well.
You can read more about the Act on our website, agnetwest.com. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, the latest U.S. topsoil moisture condition rating reflects the impacts of the summer heat and expanding drought conditions across parts of the country. With more about that, here's Rob Bain.
A drying trend in many parts of the country reflected in USDA's latest topsoil moisture report. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says for the period ending July 23rd,
topsoil moisture 43%, very short to short nationwide. That's a 5 percentage point jump from the previous week. Meanwhile, topsoil moisture surplus, just 5% of the country, down a point from last week. The emerging story here is the expanding dryness. We see numbers considerably higher in some areas. Across the Northwest, Washington State 80%, very short to short, closely followed by Oregon at 71%. Four states in the Western Corn Belt reporting topsoil moisture at least 50% short to very short, led by Missouri at 67%, followed by Minnesota 64%.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Rob. But what all does this mean when it comes to the nation's pasture and rangeland conditions? Well, USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey has a look at what the summertime weather is doing to those areas.
We still have 44% of the nation's rangeland and pastures rated in good to excellent condition. That's a 3-point drop from the previous week, but very poor to poor ratings were steady this week at 24%. We generally have an area in the Midwest and the Southern Great Plains that have the lowest pasture conditions. Leading the nation this week is Missouri, 59%, very poor to poor. Texas is next on the list at 48%. Now, we still have some pretty green pastures for this time of year, especially in the Southeast, and then extending northward all the way into the Ohio Valley and beyond. We also see that true in California, remarkable for this time of year, 70% good to excellent, and also Wyoming at 79%.
Again, that was USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey. And the American Lamb Board is seeking the help of American lamb producers and feeders on their environmental stewardship and other sustainability practices to better inform consumers and direct checkoff programs. And producers can help by completing ALB's sustainability survey. It's open through August the 14th. According to Peter Camino, ALB chair, it's so important to have solid data that actually represents what our diverse American lamb industry does, the progress we've made, and helps us continually improve productivity, animal care, and sustainability. He said the U.S. lamb industry is often misrepresented, so we need solid, new data to correctly tell our story. In addition, ALB will use the information to guide its industry education and research efforts so the checkoff funds are invested where they will make the most difference. Findings will be compared to those from a similar survey conducted back in 2011. Now, the survey takes about 30 minutes to complete, and it'll help identify areas of improvement and opportunities for further growth to help strengthen the American lamb industry. To learn more about this survey, go to AmericanLamb.com. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
The cost of eating at home is stabilizing, but dining out may cost more. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The latest information from the USDA says that the rise in grocery prices that we've been feeling is leveling off and looks to be stable for the rest of the year. However, USDA economist Matt McLaughlin says that the cost of eating out is rising faster than food at the grocery store.
Food away from home prices have continued to grow faster than food at home prices. We are looking at an expected price increase of 7.5% for food away from home, with a prediction interval between 7 and 7.9%. It's substantially lower for food at home, where we're seeing a 4.9% increase for food at home prices.
One cost that may go up at the grocery stores is beef, due to the lower supply of cattle. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan. A family farm or ranch is a great workplace, and you are the recipient and steward of a legacy that may stretch for generations. It can be the best job in the world, but working with family can create a business culture that might threaten the effective functioning of the whole operation. Working on the family farm or ranch can be a rewarding experience, but there are some dynamics that have the potential to imperil the business. For example, family members can't be fired, at least not very easily. That's because family and business are intertwined. This can be a problem if the family member should be moved along to something else. Also, family members aren't typically paid market wages, but it's always best to have a market-oriented philosophy. Family members also usually don't get feedback. This often means that the family member doesn't know where they stand, what they're doing well, and what could be done better. This can cause tension in relationships because there was little to no feedback about missed expectations over time. To be a great family farming or ranching operation, make sure to adopt practices that are common to non-family businesses. That will help ensure the future viability of your family's enterprise while at the same time allowing you to keep the benefits of working in agriculture with those that you love. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan.
USDA researchers have spent several years looking at high concentration of companies in various sectors of agribusiness and what that means regarding competition in those industries. James McDonald of the Economic Research Service is one of those studying potential correlations.
The concern is whether a situation in which a few firms dominate a market and whether they can exercise market power by either raising prices to consumers compared to what you would get in a competitive industry or reducing the price they pay to suppliers.
Three agribusiness sectors specifically were focused on in a recent study released by ERS. Meatpacking, seeds, and food retail.
We chose these three sectors because they've had really striking transformations in how business is organized within each sector over the last 20 or 30 years. And as part of that, many specific markets within each sector have become highly concentrated with just a few producers, whether it is the purchase of cattle in beef packing or the sale in various types of crop seeds or in some retail markets for food retailing.
Among the research findings in the report for the meat packing industry,
the spread between what they get paid for wholesale beef and what they pay for cattle did widen considerably since that time. At the same time, we've started to see entry by new packing plants and new firms into the business just in recent years, which is both an indication of market power and a potential solution to it by expanding capacity and offering more competition for current packers.
While in the seed industry, two seed companies accounted for 72% of planted corn acres and 66% of planted soybean acres in the U.S. in 2018.
We discussed the major mergers among seed and agricultural chemical companies that occurred back in 2016-17. We talk about what the competitive concerns were in those mergers among firms and markets in which we might only have had two or three or four producers. And we talk about the resolution. There were a number of divestitures required before those mergers go through.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Farm Bureau's Harvest for All program recently received the Power of Association Summit Award from the American Society of Association Executives. Matt Feynman, AFBF Young Farmers and Ranchers Chair, says the program helps address hunger in rural America.
So the Harvest for All program, members involved in the Young Farmer and Ranchers program take the lead in planning, coordinating, and executing the initiative, often with involvement from local community leaders and supporters. It's all about addressing hunger in rural America.
In 2022, Harvest for All participants donated 25.3 million pounds of food and $1 million to local food banks. Fyman says the award recognizes the economic and societal contributions of the program.
We're really excited about receiving the Power of Association Summit Award from the American Society of Association Executives for our successful Harvest for All initiative. It's really exciting to be able to receive this award. AFBF is one of six recipients and the only association recognized with a focus on agriculture.
Fyman says the Harvest for All program embodies the spirit of Farm Bureau.
Farm Bureau is a grassroots membership agriculture and nonprofit. We organize farmers and ranchers at the local, state, and national level so that we can serve as a voice of agriculture. And to be able to bring all these young farmers and ranchers together and have the initiative of putting together these events, often with involvement from local and community leaders and supporters, it really means a lot, and it shows that we have young people out there that want to serve a purpose.
Learn more at fb.org. Michael Clements, Washington.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Why do we have GMOs? Actually, we've been modifying crops for thousands of years to prevent crop loss from pest and weather damage, to grow more food on less land, even to improve nutrition. Today, GMOs are developed for the same reasons. With genetic engineering, scientists can change and improve crops more easily and quickly. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Oil and gas prices have spiked during July, and though a correction is in order, we wonder how much of a correction they'll actually be. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report to end the week, brought to you by Helena Agri. Gas prices have risen an average of 50 cents a gallon nationwide during July. Oil and gas futures at three-month highs. Some of the factors include China have been stockpiling supplies the past 2 months, expected, though, to slow that pace. European crude oil supplies in storage jumped 6% week over week, and U.S. saw the lowest Canadian crude oil imports by rail in 3 years. So we watch September crude oil futures above the $80-$80.50 level from here, and we'll see how eager new buyers are. This is the Bottom Line Report. Manage in-season nutrition with flexible in-season applications and maximum nutrient efficiency with Coron Metra from Helena. Visit HelenaAgra.com to learn more. USDA and private crop scouts providing final data to USDA statisticians. They're preparing that August 11th crop report. I'm Mark Oppold. That's our bottom line to end the week. We wish you a profitable day and a profitable week ahead.
If you want to go on the USDA's next ag trade mission, it's time to get that application in. Applications are now being accepted for USDA's fall-time agricultural trade mission to Singapore and Malaysia. Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs, Alexis Taylor, says Singapore is a growing market for our nation's farm and food exports.
When we look to Singapore, they are a highly urbanized nation and they rely heavily on agricultural food imports. They are a key logistics hub to the Asia Pacific region, and they host a lot of buyers from the whole region in Singapore. And so Singapore is a market that we are interested in, but getting into the Singapore market, you really are able to tap into that entire region. Our exports are growing there as well. We saw 190% growth from 2012 to 2022.
Applications are being accepted through August 2nd. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Back in the 1930s, classic comedian W.C. Fields said,
"Never give a sucker an even break or
you're smart enough a chump.
And just the other day at the White House, on a more serious note, President Biden said,
folks are tired of being played for suckers.
The president was referring to people being at the mercy of businesses which, by design or not, have gotten so big that they face little competition in the marketplace, leaving their customers little, if any, choices or power in the marketplace.
Capitalism without competition isn't capitalism, it's exploitation.
And with those words, 2 years ago, the president created a special competition council to work on the problem, which seemed to be a major situation involving food retailing and food processing. For example, in the food retailing business right now,
just four supermarket companies control over a third of the market nationwide. And it's even more concentrated at the local level, where consumers have had even fewer stores to choose from. Groceries in consolidated markets charge you more because you have nowhere else to shop.
And Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says likewise, farmers, especially producers of hogs, beef cattle, and poultry, face the same kind of thing, a squeeze from two sides.
Farmers and ranchers have been squeezed by corporate concentration and input industries like seeds, fertilizers, and even farm equipment on the one side. And on the other side, by consolidation in the channels for selling agricultural products like meat and poultry processors and grocery retail markets.
For example, 80% of the U.S. meat processing industry is controlled by only four companies, and so many of our farmers have only one outlet for their livestock and little, if any, bargaining power. The Competition Council has been working on these kinds of things, and the president has just announced a number of new executive actions designed
to increase competition and lower costs for American households.
In the food and agriculture arena, the president said the Agriculture Department,
together with bipartisan attorneys general in 31 states and the District of Columbia, are ramping up enforcement of antitrust and consumer protection laws in food and in agriculture.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said the overall goal of this effort, very plain,
crackdown on anti-competitive and anti-consumer practices that raise prices at the grocery store and deprive farmers of a fair return.
Vilsack said the crackdown would include a much more critical and close look at any proposed mergers of supermarket chains or major agricultural businesses. USDA is also continuing its efforts to promote construction of new meat processing facilities and fertilizer production plants, and to create more and better local and regional markets for farmers to sell to. So, in general,
this is going to help lower food costs for American families, while also giving farmers and ranchers more and better options.
In Washington, Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
If your soil could talk, what would it say? If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
Welcome back to the show. For today's interview segment, we have another episode of the Farm Side Chat, where American Farm Bureau President Zippy Duvall talks all about the surprising uses of cotton with Texas cotton farmer Colin Chopless.
Good morning, President Duvall. Thanks for having me and putting this together, and looking forward to a conversation today. And my name is Colin Chopless, and I'm a fifth-generation farmer from the southern part of Texas, down here what we call the Coastal Bend. So we're located just north of Corpus Christi, Texas, and that's about 2 hours from the Rio Grande Valley and the Mexico border, and about 2 hours south of San Antonio. So
I think it's kind of kin to okra or some other plant. What would you say is kin to?
Well, you know, cotton is a very it's very different from a lot of the other commodities that farmers are used to growing. And, you know, we certainly enjoy growing it on our farm, but it certainly has a lot of challenges associated with it also. You know, we also grow corn and grain sorghum, which are more traditional of a grass crop and probably something that most listeners are familiar with. But you know, cotton is definitely a different animal altogether. It kind of grows similar to a soybean, but quite a bit different as well. So we start planting cotton down here in late February, early March, which, you know, we're in the southern part of Texas, and Texas is a very large state, as y'all know. So in the northern part of the state, they haven't even began or just now starting to plant cotton. And we already have cotton that's been in the ground for a couple months now. So it's a very diverse growing region across the state of Texas and across the United States, of course. But so we plant a little early down here for various reasons. You know, one just being we're a warmer climate. We get our soil temperatures up a lot faster. Usually we'll be in the 60 degree range of our soil temperatures pretty early on in the year. And that's a good time to go ahead and start putting some cottonseed in the ground. And, you know, assuming we have a little moisture to work with, then things are off and running down here.
Compared to the other commodities you grow, corn and others, is it the first crop that you put in the ground or second or third?
No, sir. So cotton is actually the last crop we'll plant. We usually start with corn around Valentine's Day, and then we'll transition into grain sorghum after that. And then we'll finish up with cotton. And, you know, just depending on kind of how the planting year goes, you know, cotton may be right there around the 1st of March going in the ground, but a lot of times it's later towards the end of March. And that can tend to be better in the long run. You know, the day length is a little bit longer, the soil's a little warmer, and so things tend to grow a little faster later in the year. But, you know, one of the unique things about this region of Texas, and something we always have to be concerned about, is we're located just a matter of miles from the Gulf of Mexico. And so there's always that threat in August and September of having any kind of tropical weather. You know, people always think of hurricanes and stuff, but really just getting a tropical wave or a depression come in here, and we can get, you know, 10 to 15 inches of rain and literally ruin a cotton crop right before harvest. And that can certainly be very hard to fathom having something like that happen, but it does happen from time to time. So we try to get in a little earlier.
So was it Harvey that came in several years ago that did so much destruction?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yeah. 2017 had Hurricane Harvey, went in about 35 miles from where I'm sitting right now. And we were very fortunate to have all of our cotton harvested in round modules or round bales, which we now put cotton in, and at the cotton gin. A lot of producers just a little bit further up the coast as you get closer to Houston still had a lot of that cotton in the field. And unfortunately, majority of that was completely ruined and was lost.
Yeah, that was devastating. I had been elected about a year as American Farm Bureau president. I came down and visited that area, and I could not believe what I saw when I came down there. I mean, some of the round bales had floated into the wood.
Yes.
I mean, the stacks, what do you call it? The square stack.
Oh, the conventional modules that look like
yeah, the modules. I saw they had blown them off. They were about a foot high instead of 6 foot tall, and it was devastating. I had never seen. It looked like a bomb had went off in that.
Yes, place. That's the best way to describe it. It looks like a bomb went off. It was absolutely incredible.
And I mean, there was cotton in the trees, hanging on the side of buildings, and it was amazing how that wind just tore it off.
And we had a fantastic crop that year, one of the best cotton yields we'd had in a very long time. And that went all the way up the coast. And those farmers were so unfortunate to lose nearly all of their crop that year. It was really devastating.
Right. So let's talk about that. You talked a little bit of you've already planted and where it's at now and the risk of harvesting it during hurricane season. Talk about the rest of the lifespan of the cotton plant and what are you having to do it along? This show will run about the end of July. What do you think you'll be doing the end of July?
Sure. So we always say one of the hardest challenges of growing cotton is just to get it out of the ground the first time. And so once we get the plant up and established, you know, it's really just a matter of Mother Nature and us taking care of the plant to get us along. So, you know, of course, having ample rainfall at the right time is extremely important. We have very little irrigation in this region of Texas. That's quite a bit different from western parts of Texas where they rely heavily on irrigation. But typically we get around 30 inches of rainfall a year. And so that's sufficient to grow cotton. And one of the reasons we grow cotton is it doesn't take as much water as other things like corn do. So We'll continue to manage pests are our biggest issue. Again, we're in a very warm climate, so everything grows and everything wants to eat our crop down here. So we spend a lot of time managing pest issues. And of course, you know, spraying insecticides and fungicides are extremely expensive and something that we only do when it's absolutely necessary to apply those kind of products. And so, you know, we try to do the best we can to take care of our crop. And as it grows and progresses, we get towards the July and August timeframe, and the plant begins to naturally shut down, and those bowls that have been formed open. And that's where we see the white fluffy cotton inside those bowls. And when it gets to a completed point, we apply a product on there that causes the leaves to fall off. It doesn't kill the plant, but it does take all the leaves off the plant so that we can harvest it easier and that we get less what we call trash or that leaf material in our cotton sample, right? Everybody wants to have that bright white fluffy cotton. And so that's how that process kind of works. And, you know, hopefully, again, we don't get any bad weather once that cotton is exposed and completely open to the elements and we have a successful harvest.
Cotton, we all know cotton used a lot of t-shirts, a lot of blue jeans. Tell us some other products that it might be used in.
Sure. So, you know, cotton is such a unique crop and a unique product, right? I mean, first of all, the plant's goal is to grow seed to reproduce. And the lint fiber, the white lint that we're most common with, is actually grown as a byproduct to protect that seed. So, you know, we're using the cotton lint, and that goes into so many different things. I mean, I promise you, every one of your listeners today have already interacted with American cotton, whether that be the bed sheets that you slept on, the clothes you put on this morning. The money that's in your wallet has a large percentage of cotton in it. So many different things in the medical field that utilizes the cotton fiber. My wife and I are expecting our first baby in September, and lots of cotton.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Lots of cotton that goes into those products such as diapers and baby wipes. And that's something my wife's been very vigilant of is, you know, we want to have the best thing for the baby, and that's American cotton, right? So
that's right.
We're looking forward to that. But, you know, and another big use is that cotton seed, right? So the seed doesn't go to waste at all. Some of it's going to be retained and used again next year to plant again. A large amount of it will go into animal feed. It's a very good source of protein. And something kind of unique that we use it for down here is a lot of our large white-tailed deer operations will feed cotton seed as a supplement. So, you know, the traditional corn feeder on a deer ranch has kind of changed a little bit. Now it's got a feeder feeding cotton seed right next to it also.
This was just a portion of their conversation. To listen to the full episode, visit fb.org. Stay tuned. We'll have more Ag News after the break.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Welcome back. We've got more Ag News right now.
Applications are currently being accepted for the Climate Smart Cotton Program. Senior scientist for the U.S. Cotton Trust Protocol, Chad Brewer, described the different levels of enrollment and the enrollment process for the program.
During that application process, they have the ability to select that they're interested in climate smart agricultural practices, such as cover crops and using no-tillage production practices, as well as developing a nutrient management plan. So we have financial incentives for adoption of those three production practices in our level two enrollment. The level three enrollment is an option to enter into the carbon market because they made new production practice changes. Enrollment is on a first come, first served basis, so the total enrollment will be 1,650 growers across the U.S. Now, 330 of those spots are reserved for historically underserved cotton growers. They can begin their enrollment process by visiting trustuscotton.org.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Growth Energy recently filed an amicus brief in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit in the San Antonio Refinery, LLC, versus the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. The case pertains to a group of refineries seeking to avoid complying with the renewable fuel standard, which requires oil refineries to blend a specific amount of biofuels into their fuel each year. The petitioning refineries allege that the EPA's alternative RIN retirement schedule for small refineries, an adjustment made to allow refineries to meet their RFS obligations over an extended period of time, did not go far enough and should have allowed the refineries not to comply with RFS at all. Growth Energy's amicus brief reiterates the fact the oil industry continues to look for ways to avoid complying with RFS. Growth Energy CEO Emily Score says, quote, "The oil industry should stop playing the victim and get on board with the most successful climate policy enacted to date." NAFB contributed to that report.
The California Department of Food and Agriculture seeking public comments on priorities being developed for the new Resilient Food Systems Infrastructure Program. The program's designed to bolster resilience in the middle of the supply chain, processing and transportation to a warehouse or distribution center. In partnership with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, CDFA will administer a competitive solicitation to award grants supporting infrastructure for domestic food and farm businesses and other eligible entities. CDFA will draft program priorities that will inform a state plan and ultimately help guide prospective applicants to submit projects that address the most relevant issues affecting the industry. CDFA is asking for public comments and suggestions submitted through the Resilient Food Systems Infrastructure webpage. Input received by 5 p.m. on August 3rd will be reviewed and utilized to inform the state plan priorities that are submitted to USDA. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.